Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll learn about the author Mark Twain. Biographer Ron Chernow discusses his new book. Twain grew up in Hannibal, Missouri, along the Mississippi River. His career took him all over the world, but despite his fame, there is a lot about him people don't know or get wrong. That conversation is ahead. Also this week marked the 130th anniversary of Buckminster Fuller's birth. An architect, writer, and visionary, Fuller taught at SIU Carbondale, and his former home is now a museum. We'll find out the plans for that attraction. A Central Illinois Republican congressman sits down to discuss the controversial mega bill that the GOP approved and why he says it's good for the country. Also, an effort to protect a water source from carbon sequestration. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. First this week, the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Ron Chernow discusses his latest book, Mark Twain. It paints a nuanced portrait of a complicated American author from the heartland. Twain had many challenges, including too much debt in his immediate family and a long litany of financial hardships that nearly crushed him. But Chernow says Twain can be credited with transforming American literature by writing about the individuals and landscapes of the Midwest, which up until that point enjoyed little representation in fiction. He talked with Steve Kraske.
Ron, welcome.
Lovely to be with you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So why Mark Twain? Why now, Ron?
Well, you know, my obsession with Mark Twain dates back to 1974. I was a 25-year-old freelance magazine writer in Philadelphia. And one night I saw there were posters up that said, "Mark Twain tonight, exclamation point." And it was a one-man show by the actor Hal Holbrook.
Absolutely.
He stood up there for 90 minutes in the trademark white suit with the cigar and the unruly hair. And he spouted one political witticism after another that had me howling with laughter. He said, "There's no distinctly Native American criminal class, except for Congress." Or he said, suppose you're an idiot, and suppose you're a congressman, but I repeat myself. He said, I say it with pride, that we have legislatures that fetch higher prices than any other in the world. Anyway, I was not only howling with laughter at this, but it amazed me that these were lines that were more than 100 years old, that were still so fresh and funny, and unfortunately still so pertinent. So that began this lifelong obsession with Twain, not only in terms of Twain as a novelist, but Twain as an all-purpose political pundit. And Twain is, in many ways, is our original celebrity. I mean, he anticipates this whole influencer culture that engulfs us now.
How did he do that? Because that's one of your points in this book, that he practically invented celebrity culture. How did he do it?
I think that he did it in a couple of ways. You know, he realized that to become a modern celebrity, you have to be an instantly recognizable figure. So he began this trademark white suit.
Right.
Now, the first time he appeared in the white suit, the reporter said to him, "What's the meaning of this?" And he said, "This is the uniform of the American Association of Purity and Perfection, of which I am the president and sole member." And then he did other things, like he was very colorful. He would give interviews sitting up in bed in his nightshirt. He was a little bit like Groucho Marx in that way. But he also lent his name and image to a lot of product endorsements, something that it's hard to imagine a Henry James or an Edith Wharton doing. For instance, the Wirt Fountain Pen Company signed him up, and not only would have Mark Twain's name and image, but he wrote the copy for them. So he wrote in the copy that, "With one Wirt pen, I have supported my family for many years. With two Wirt pens, I could have grown rich." I mean, what other author of that time, our own time, would have lent himself to that sort of publicity? But he loved, from the time that he was a boy, he loved attention, and that didn't fail him throughout his life.
The white suit thing, we think of him always in a white suit, but that didn't begin until pretty late in his life, right?
Yeah, where he wore only the white suits, that was the last 4 years. In fact, he bought 14 of them so that he had one for each day of the week while the seven others were at the cleaners. He said that he was the only cleanly clothed person in the dirty world, and he became increasingly, you know, pessimistic about the state of humanity. In fact, in his later years, he said that if he had created humanity, he would have hidden his head in a bag in shame.
Ron Chernow, the great biographer, is my guest. His new book is titled simply Mark Twain. You know, we all think of him, you know, as a fun uncle or a to-die-for grandfather, but is that really who he was?
You know, he could be irreverent and charming and utterly delightful, but also kind of very, you know, moody and temperamental. Mm-hmm. He married a very rich and very refined woman named Livy Langdon from upstate New York. And as Twain himself admitted, he was a mighty rough, coarse customer when they met. And she had to train him in anger management. He was a very volatile personality, so that he had a tendency to dash off angry and impetuous letters. And she taught him, after he wrote the letter, to stash it in the drawer for a few days until he cooled down. Or there are a lot of letters in his papers where the morning after a dinner party, you'd see Mark Twain writing to someone. The madam tells me I may have been a little sharp and brusque with you at dinner last night, and I apologize. Uh-huh. But, you know, they actually worked out because she was making him presentable in polite society. They worked out a system of color-coded cards. A red card that she flashed meant to him, are you going to monopolize that woman on your right all night? a blue card meant, are you going to sit back and not say anything throughout the dinner
wow,
party?
Wow, wow, wow.
But they adored each other. It was a happy, I mean, there's hardly a letter from Livy to Mark or Sam Clemens, as he was originally born. There's hardly a letter that he wrote to her that she wrote to him that didn't end, I adore you, I worship you, I idolize you, and that was fully reciprocated. And the daughters used to call this process of mother training father, mother dusting off father, and Twain himself admitted in later life, he said, Livy edited my manuscripts, and then she edited me.
Not a bad thing, maybe. Well, he stuffed so much living into his 74 years, Ron. That comes through so clearly in this book. You almost can't believe he still managed to churn out as many words as he did. What's your sense? How did he manage it all?
Well, you know, first I should mention, because most people, if they have read Mark Twain these days, maybe they've read, you know, Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn, maybe Life on the Mississippi.
Right.
But he published 24 books in his lifetime. Most people don't know he published a novel on Joan of Arc. He published a book about Mary Baker Eddy, He Didn't Like, the founder of Christian Science. He even published a book about Shakespeare. He was fanatically convinced that the plays that we attribute to Shakespeare were written by Francis Bacon. So he was constantly writing her thousands of magazine articles. It was really difficult to keep up with him, even though he would always describe himself as very lazy, and yet he left behind probably the best documented record of any American writer.
I was going to say, given all that, how easily did the writing come to him, Ron? Because you write in here that at one point during the writing of Huckleberry Finn, that he was turning out dozens of pages of manuscript a day. He was so focused. It was really something to behold.
Yeah, although I have to mention, you know, he would write on sheets with a very large lettering.
Mm.
And the reason that he did that is he loved to say at the end of the day, I wrote 50 pages today. It might be his handwriting had been a little smaller. Mm. It would have been a dozen, and it wouldn't have sounded quite as impressive. He had a method of writing unlike that of any writer I've encountered. So he would work on a novel for 6 months. He would kind of lose his original head of steam. Then he would pick up another unfinished novel. Sometimes he was working on 3 or 4 novels simultaneously. And it was not unusual, like in the case of Huck Finn, went on for about 7 years. I think Mark Twain, 3 years. I'm not aware of any writer who would have been able to keep re-entering the mood, but particularly having jumped off to several others in the meantime.
So your sense of him today, was he America's finest author?
No, I don't think so. I think that he wrote several indisputably great books. I think that, you know, Huck Finn was his masterpiece.
Right.
But, you know, I was attracted to him, Steve, almost as much as Mark Twain, the all-purpose political pundit. You know, Mark Twain, the original celebrity. Early in his career, he was very reluctant to express his real views, particularly his political views. But where most of us mellow as we get older, Twain became more fearless and outspoken. Somebody whom the reporters would knew that they could always get something fresh and funny and original from him. So he spoke out on all sorts of things, and a lot of things that he said today I think are still very relevant. He was infuriated by the expression, "My country, right or wrong." He said, "Our country we should support always. Our government we should support only when it deserves it." He was also very bothered by the hyper-partisanship of his day. He made the statement that if the Democrats adopted the multiplication table in their electoral platform, the Republicans would vote it down at the next election. You know, and he was also, and, you know, as a former journalist and as a biographer, you know, I love the fact he was a big defender of freedom of the press. He said that reverence is the surest defense of liberty. And one of my favorite lines is he said that the devil's aversion to holy water is a light matter compared to a despot's dread of a newspaper that laughs. A very handy line.
What did he ultimately bring to our literature that hadn't been brought to it before, Ron?
Well, you know, he liked to say that he never wrote for the cultivated classes, that he wrote for the masses. He said the cultivated classes could go to the theater and opera. He had no need to entertain them. He once said that fine literature was like wine. He said his writing was like water. Then he paused and added, "But everyone drinks water." So I think that what he added was that he took, you know, for one thing, of course, he grew up in Hannibal, Missouri, on the Mississippi, so he was right smack in the middle of the country. He once wrote, "I am not an American, I am the American," and it is arrogant, but perhaps there was truth to it. So he took a lot of kind of ordinary people and wrote books about them in their own voice. So here's this whole kind of, you know, the literary world had been very much dominated by kind of Eastern Seaboard elite. And here he's capturing all this kind of, you know, wild, throbbing energy out there in the heartland, all the sort of, you know, wild men who populate our country who had not found their way into fiction before. So he really opened it up. And also when he wrote Huck Finn, suddenly, you know, here was a book not only about this street urchin and gutter snipe, but narrated by that street urchin and gutter snipe in his own voice. This is really quite revolutionary in American letters.
You know, you're obviously have some background in taking on these huge personalities, these people of massive accomplishment, George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, Ulysses S. Grant. What was the particular challenge for you in tackling this book on Mark Twain?
Well, it turned out that he was just a much, much more complicated character than I had ever imagined. And also, he had nine lives. I mean, his father dies at 11, and he becomes a printer's devil. Then he's a steamboat pilot on the Mississippi. Then he tries his hand at mining in Nevada. Then he becomes a journalist. Then he becomes a novelist. I spend a lot of time on the book that he was inventor and an investor and failed in almost everything that he tried. And the tragedy, the irony of his life is he made a fortune from his books and his lecture fees. And his bride, Livy Langdon, was an heiress. They built a 25-room mansion in Hartford, Connecticut, with a loyal staff of six servants. They could have had the easiest and most placid life imaginable, but because of his compulsive urge to speculate in different investments, goes bankrupt, and the family is forced into exile in Europe for 9 years to economize. So we think of him as the quintessential American writer, but he spent extensive periods living in Berlin, Vienna, Paris, London, and all he spent 11 years of his life outside the United States, so that this, again, American from the heartland, was actually quite worldly and cosmopolitan and spent more time outside the country than anyone else. So this was kind of a lot to encompass. You know, writing about Mark Twain, you find you have a real tiger by the tail. You have to hold on pretty tight.
This, I thought, was really interesting. He, you know, Twain obviously has this incredible imagination, but you write in here that the original idea for one of his most popular books, which was Life on the Mississippi, it actually wasn't his idea. Whose was it?
Yeah, it was actually his friend Joseph Twitchell.
Right.
Yeah, at first, this is a very strange thing, because at first it didn't seem to occur to him, okay, he's grown up in Hannibal, Missouri. That's all the way up in the northeast corner of Missouri. It's a very beautiful, very kind of isolated rural area. Is living in this mansion in Hartford. And at first it doesn't seem to occur to him to reach back into his own early life. And, of course, that for him is the mother lode. You know, that's the gold mine. And his friend Joseph Twitchell, who was a close friend and a minister, suggested to him that he write about the Mississippi. And his years, it took him 2 years to get a pilot's license on the Mississippi. As he said, the steamboat pilots on the Mississippi were the kind of undisputed royalty at the time. And that period was extremely important. He said, oh, that was the darling existence. There was nothing he enjoyed more. And just as a writer, that experience on the Mississippi for several years brought him in contact with every type of humanity. He had kind of a wonderful, you know, ear for dialogue and slang, so he's kind of picking up all of this language. He has time to read as well. So it's very, very strange that it's not until he's really in his 30s and 40s that it begins to occur to him that he can take his very colorful childhood. Tom Sawyer is very much, you know, Mark Twain's self-portrait of his boyhood in terms of someone who was sort of mischievous and always hunting for adventure and gerbil fantasies. But it was late. And I think what happened, it was kind of only when he was really kind of comfortably settled in a marriage with family that in his imagination he could begin to reach back into the town of Hannibal and all of his own experiences.
That's biographer Ron Chernow talking about his latest book, Mark Twain. We'll hear more right after this. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. We now continue with our conversation with the biographer Ron Chernow. He's talking about his latest book, Mark Twain. He's speaking with Steve Kransky.
Let's talk about race just for a few minutes here.
Yep.
Obviously, Huckleberry Finn continues to be controversial, if only because of Twain's rampant use of the N-word throughout that book. What should we make of that today? I mean, some people would still conclude he was a racist. Was he a racist?
No, exactly the opposite. Mm. He starts out, okay, he grows up in a slave-owning family in a slave-owning town. You read his teenage letters, crude racist remarks. You know, as his life goes on, he becomes the most broad-minded and intolerant of all white authors in the 20th century. I mean, Huckleberry Finn is the great anti-slavery,
right,
you know, novel language. He's using the N-word 200 times, not to endorse slavery, but to expose the slavery that has pervaded the minds of Huck and these other people. I mean, what other white author of the 19th century would have said that American liberty should date not from 1776, but 1865, when slavery was abolished? Or he mockingly said that the Declaration of Independence should have said all white men are created equal. He ended up paying for the education of two black students, one of them Warner T. McGuinn at Yale Law School. And he wrote, Twain wrote to the dean of the law school and said, we have ground the manhood out of them, the blacks, and the shame is ours, that he felt personally responsible as a white man for the wrong that had been done to the black race. Warner T. McGuinn ended up becoming a famous lawyer and a mentor to Thurgood Marshall, who argued Brown versus Board of Ed and became the first black associate justice of the Supreme Court.
Right.
So as Twain goes on, there's no sort of greater friend of the black community than Mark Twain. And so the N-word, which I understand the discomfort that it creates, but it should not be misconstrued in terms of a reflection on Mark Twain's racism.
You know, another interesting nugget from this book, 220 pages in, you mention a woman named Mary Ann Cord. She was black, yeah. She was a cook, and she had been born into slavery. Fascinating conversation she has one day with Mark Twain, who asked her point blank, how is it that you've lived 60 years and never had any trouble? He's thinking, looking at her as someone who has glided through life, not really having been slowed down because of the color of her skin. How did she respond to that, Ron? And what did Twain take away from that? Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, he used to spend his summers in Elmira, New York, where his in-laws had a farm. And there was this wonderful cook, Mary Ann Cord. She was a hardy black woman in her 60s or 70s. She always had a laugh on her lips. And Mark Twain asked her one day at sunset, they're sitting on the porch, hey, how is it you haven't had any trouble in your life? And she turned on him and she said, are you in earnest, Mr. Clemens?
Yes, right.
She couldn't believe that he had asked that naive question. Well, she then began to spill out her entire life story, which was that she had indeed been born into slavery. In slavery, had been married and had seven children. She and her husband and the seven children were put up on the block at a slave auction. And in an instant, you know, her husband and seven children were torn away from her. She never saw her husband again, and she never saw six of the seven children again. And she then said mockingly at the end, oh, no, I've never had any trouble, Mr. C.
Wow.
He then published in the Atlantic Monthly an article called The True Story, repeated, you know, word for word as I heard it. It was actually the first article under his byline that appeared in the Atlantic Monthly. And he said later in his life, because Mark Twain was a pen name for Sam Clemens, he said later in his life that he was sorry that he had not created two pen names. He was always concerned that if he wrote something serious, like the article about Mary Ann Cord, that readers who always expected something funny from him would be disappointed. So he was sorry he had not established a pen name for the funny stuff and then another name for all the serious stuff that was on his mind.
Interesting. You write in the book that in revising Huckleberry Finn, he winds up shifting the slavery subplot to become the main focus of the narrative. Why did he make that switch? And I assume this was a huge change in what this book became.
Yeah, well, you know, Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn both take place in the same town. It's called St. Petersburg in the fiction. It was actually Hannibal in reality. But he did Tom Sawyer, which is a very, very charming book about, you know, American boyhood innocence. It was his town, but it was his town without slavery. And I think as he started to write Huck, he realized that, you know, this gigantic blot on the whole town was slavery that just permeated everything that that happened. And it's interesting, the other controversy with Huck Finn has to do with the portrayal of Jim. Now, Jim is, on the one hand, far and away the most sensitive and dignified and affectionate character in the book. The whites are almost all violent and crude and profane, but there are certain, it's called minstrel affectations, Jim, you know, he's superstitious, he's credulous. And so, you know, black critics going back 75 years, and not just black critics, you know, have argued that there were sort of, you know, traits from minstrel shows that were grafted onto to Jim. And I think there's some truth to that. And it was the reason that Percival Everett, in his wonderful book,
right.
James, decided to retell the story from Jim / James's point of view and get rid of, you know, the racist caricatures. And so it's not, you know, it's a great book. It's not a perfect book. I don't think that a white author writing about race relations in the 19th century could have published a book that we would consider perfect today. I think it's amazing that Mark Twain went as far as he did. The fact that he didn't reach the promised land, I think, shouldn't entirely surprise us.
You write in here that he once said that Tom Sawyer was really himself. Does that make sense to you today, Ron?
Yeah, I think so, because Mark Twain said, you know, from the time that he was a boy, he said that celebrity is what a boy loves more than anything else. He would be a pirate. He would be a clown. He would sell himself to the devil if he could attract the attention and notice of other boys. And so I point out his entire life he was trying to attract attention. He admitted that he had an appetite for notice and notoriety, and he did tell his daughters that the character of Tom Sawyer was really a self-portrait.
That's biographer Ron Chernow. He's added Mark Twain to the list of subjects he's written about with his latest book. He spoke with Steve Kresge. Earlier this year, a bill to ban carbon sequestration under sole source aquifers in Illinois passed the General Assembly with overwhelming bipartisan support. At the time this show was recorded, the governor had yet to act on it. Some scientists say the approach is a necessary tool for tackling climate change, especially because carbon dioxide makes up nearly 80% of all greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. Sam Rink reports the debate over carbon sequestration is not going away.
Carbon sequestration is the process where carbon dioxide is captured, compressed, and injected into absorbent rock layers deep underground. In Illinois, a prime location for this is under the Mahomet Aquifer, which also happens to be the main source of water for over 800,000 people stretching from Iroquois County to Cass County. And that concerns Democratic State Representative Carol Ammons.
It's about our community being able to turn a water faucet on and drink water from that tap that is not contaminated with any toxins whatsoever.
But many experts who've spoken to lawmakers insist the practice is safe. Randy Locke is the chief scientist for research and development with the Illinois State Geological Survey. The organization provides information about geology and natural resources for the public and legislators.
So storage is occurring over a mile underground, and the local water sources are less than 200 to 500 feet from the land surface.
The Mahomet Aquifer is thousands of feet above the rock formations where CO2 would be injected. And the layers of rock separating the two include a thick layer of cap rock, which is sometimes referred to as a seal. Locke says that would prevent the gas from reaching shallow aquifers.
So there's a distinct separation between where potable water occurs and where the storage is occurring.
As for the injection wells that are bored through an aquifer, those are surrounded by multiple layers of steel and concrete to prevent contamination. But carbon sequestration isn't a perfect solution. Andrew Rain is the director of climate policy at the Illinois-based Prairie Rivers Network.
You could have chemical constituents that are stable in the pH ranges that you're seeing now, and that if CO2 were to leak, those could start leaching pollutants.
He says there are growing questions about the safety of carbon sequestration after two leaks occurred in an Archer Daniels Midland facility in Decatur last year. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, equipment malfunctions there caused carbon dioxide and brine to leak, violating the company's injection permit. But the leaks occurred so far below ground, they did not impact drinkable water. And the Decatur site is several miles outside the boundaries of the Mahomet Aquifer. So, how likely is it that the aquifer could be contaminated by a CO2 leak?
I was very worried about water back when I started.
That's Susan Havorka. She's a senior research scientist at the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin.
And I have, through experience, convinced myself that the risk to water is negligible, truly negligible.
Her research has shown that while a leak could cause toxic metals to be released, the impacts are often minimal. She also says each well requires site-specific testing and risk assessment as part of the permitting process to construct the wells and inject CO2. Despite this, Rain says leaks are still cause for concern.
The reality is that when you're doing something so big, failure points that you didn't expect are going to show up.
But Havorka warns against writing off the technology entirely.
The impact to the aquifer from uncontrolled climate change is much more severe. Because it's a near-surface, valley-filled aquifer, so if there's episodes of drying or flooding, or any kind of changes in climate are serious risks to the aquifer.
The use of carbon sequestration is expanding on a large commercial scale, and several projects have already been proposed in central Illinois, including some under the Mahomet Aquifer. For Randy Locke, the continuing research and development of carbon sequestration technology is a good thing. He compares it to the risks of driving a car.
There are things in our daily lives that we accept as things that are commonplace, but they do actually carry risk. The things that have happened with evolution of well design, changing of the wells, all of those things help make future projects safer.
24 well applications are currently under review by the EPA in Illinois. And while it's uncertain what Governor J.B. Pritzker plans to do with the bill banning carbon sequestration, some lawmakers say they have the numbers to override a potential veto. I'm Sam Rink, IPM News.
An ice storm early this spring cracked and knocked down trees across an estimated 3 million acres in northern Michigan. Months later, parts of the forest floor are still covered with sticks and debris from the downed trees. And as Harvest Public Media contributor A.J. Jones reports, timber industry and environmental officials are rushing to salvage what they can.
A large track harvester is clearing a field of damaged trees in this state forest near Kaler. Billy Bogner is one of the operators at Precision Forestry, a company that's working to help clean up after the historic ice storm.
The ones that are still standing, most of the tops are on the ground, so we'll cut the main tree down, delimb that, and cut that to length, and then grab the top.
The early spring storm left over 145,000 people without power across northern Michigan, some for more than a week. It also caused property damage across the region. Tricia St. Pierre is a forester with the State Department of Natural Resources. As she drives through, surveying the damage, St. Pierre explains how the ice storm ravaged a big portion of the state's forests.
Just over 900,000 acres, which is almost a quarter of the state forest that we manage.
Forest land is a big deal here. Michigan's forests contributed over $26 billion to the economy, according to the latest numbers. It also contributed directly to over 40,000 jobs. State officials and private foresters are rushing to salvage what wood they can. Michael Jacobson is a professor of forest resources at Penn State. He says salvage logging helps extract some profit from damaged forests.
The idea is that there's probably still some value in the trees, even if they've broken off at the tops. You know, some of the wood could be used for low-value uses like biofuels, fuel wood, other new products that are coming in that could be used from wood.
But clearing debris and broken trees is also important for forest health. Jacobson says doing this well takes expertise and can help protect the long-term health of the forest.
Generally, with salvage logging, it doesn't mean that you're taking out everything. And if you do it well with a good forester, you'll be able to, you know, leave important trees that are important for environment or wildlife, and also protect the soils.
And a critical part of protecting forest health after damaging storms is to clean up dead wood before invasive species get a foothold. In Michigan, that includes bark beetles, which can spread oak wilt and other diseases that kill trees. Simeon Wright, a forest health pathologist with Michigan's Department of Natural Resources, says it's urgent to protect the wider forest.
As soon as there's broken material on the ground that hasn't dried out yet, those bark beetles can successfully reproduce in those materials and start to build higher populations that can overcome the defenses of healthier trees.
Back in Tricia St. Pierre's state vehicle, she says there's a lot of work still left to do. She says it's hard to know what the long-term consequences of the storm will be for Michigan's forests.
So we haven't really seen the impacts of a storm in this capacity. Natural disturbance on a large scale is a very natural part of the forest, of the environment. Forest succession kind of depends on those disturbances, but something this scale, being from an ice storm, that's unprecedented for us.
This crew is removing and knocking down leaning trees, which they call widowmakers. Michigan's parks were able to open before the summer vacation season, but they still have thousands of acres to clear. For Harvest Public Media, I'm A.J. Jones.
With a record number of measles cases in the U.S., doctors are encouraging summer travelers to get vaccinated. Measles is so contagious it can linger in the air for up to 2 hours after an infected person coughs or sneezes. Dr. Tina Tan is an infectious disease specialist in Chicago.
The best way, and really the only way, to protect yourself is to vaccinate you and your family members that can be vaccinated.
She recommends adults who were born before the early 1990s and had one measles shot get a second one, and says people should wear an N95 or surgical mask if they're in crowded places like an airport. Babies who are too young to get the measles vaccine and those who are pregnant are at a higher risk of serious complications if they get sick. We'll head to Southern Illinois next on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. 130 years ago this week, Buckminster Fuller was born. Fuller was seen by many as a visionary, and while his most visible work may be developing architecture around the geodesic dome, he was also a futurist, philosopher, and sustainability advocate, among just a few of his accomplishments. Fuller was a professor at SIU for a little more than 10 years during the 1960s, and during his time there he built a home in Carbondale, that is, a geodesic dome. The building was placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 2006. And that building has been turned into a museum and renovated to show visitors what it looked like when Fuller and his wife owned and lived there. Brian Sapp has more.
The R. Buckminster Fuller Dome Home, not-for-profit, is the organization running the home. They've begun work building a new visitor center to share even more about Fuller's life and works.
His challenge, make the world work for 100% of humanity in the shortest possible time through spontaneous cooperation without ecological offense or disadvantage of anyone.
Elizabeth Donahue is the president of the Fuller Dome Board. She gave me a tour of the home to explain their work.
We're putting a lot of the structures in place and the work in place, like laying the groundwork for a vision that we have where we'll be able to accommodate more people visiting and be able to have educational programming and inspire educational programming to happen in a more broad way.
She dreams they can use the new visitor center to show the depth of Fuller's creations and what he gave to the world.
And so I see it as an inspiring starting point for people. That we often kind of grew up in these ways where we're taught in silos. I think on that level, educational, but also really hands-on problem-solving and inspiring others to live a life. He lived his life dedicated to humanity, and living a life like that is a very inspiring thing. So.
But also a public space, gathering space, all in celebration of Bucky and those associated with him. And there's quite a few of those individuals.
Thad Heckman and Ed Cook are leading the work being done to finish building the visitor center. Heckman is the architect behind the design. Cook is the project manager overseeing its installation. He also led the work that was done to renovate the home. Both men studied design at SIU. They came to the university just a few years after Fuller left. But both men were able to attend lectures from Fuller when he made return visits. Heckman says he's working on the project because his love for geometry as a child led him on a path to meet Fuller.
There was this guy they were talking about called Bucky Fuller, and the geometry just, I'm still getting goosebumps. And I was fortunate to, both of us have attended his lectures. I met him, he came to my class when I was a junior, I think it was. And started reading his books like we all do locally that are Bucky fans. And so it's, as I mentioned a moment ago, it's a labor of love. Glad to do it.
Just one of the ways that Fuller's inspiration can be seen in the building is that of sustainability. The home was 3D printed by a company called Mighty Buildings. Ed Cook explains how the building went together.
The panels were printed in a plant in Monterrey, Mexico, and it was virtually all automated, all robotic stuff. And the panels are ready for construction immediately. But anyway, the crew came and we started setting the panels, and it just was like, it was just amazingly simple. Everyone that worked on this project had cared the same amount that I did.
One of the leading criteria for designing the visitor center was to think, what would Bucky do?
Why would he want his visitor center to be just some wooden box? So when Thad researched this a little bit and found out about some, you know, the 3D printing, we were like, Bucky would have been all over 3D printing.
Donahue looks forward to the time when they can move into the visitor center and share more of Fuller's work. She's already seen his impact bringing the community together to reach a wide variety of people.
And it's community building. because there's so many entry points to Fuller. Kids can have fun putting the models together, learning about certain things. Oh, that looks like a really cool gadget there, right? Adults can enter at certain points too. We see so many people that are connected to Fuller or were inspired by Fuller that are doing so many different things. Designers, architects, engineers, all kinds of, you know, storytellers, artists. And so I really feel that it's community building at a local level, but there's the potential for it at a global level.
Brian Sapp with that report. The goal is to have the visitor center for the Buckminster Fuller Dome home open in the next 1 to 2 years. To help with the costs, a capital campaign is being launched. Central Illinois Congressman Darren LaHood is praising what was called the Big Beautiful Bill that he voted for. In an interview with Charlie Schlinker, the Republican LaHood says it will benefit the nation.
I think you got to fix the economy, and I think this bill goes a long way of doing that. In particular, if you look at the tax cuts that were made permanent in this bill and how they affect agriculture community and the business community, things like making 100% bonus depreciation permanent, the research and development tax credit, making that permanent. The 199A, making that permanent. These are all the estate tax provisions that affect many of our family farmers, making those permanent. Those are, I think, an example of getting the economy back on track. Now, ultimately, we want to bring down inflation, bring down interest rates to make things more affordable, bring down the cost of energy. So there's many things in there that I believe will get the economy back on track.
Fiscal conservatives, though, have noted that the previous tax bill didn't stimulate economic growth anywhere close to the amount needed to pay for itself. How is this different, since a lot of the cuts are extensions of the existing provisions?
So I think that's a fair question. If you go back to the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which I supported, I would argue that created the best economy in my lifetime. Now, if you look at the statistics, we moved over that period of time when it passed to right before COVID, we moved 6.5 million people out of poverty across the country. So every economic level benefited. Those aren't my facts. Those are facts that the Department of Treasury put out. Also, we had record high wages, record low unemployment. We had record growth in the economy. And then COVID got in the way and disrupted a lot of that. But making permanent a number of those provisions that expire at the end of this year was part of what we predicated this bill on. We want predictability and certainty in the economy. And then the last point that I'll make, in this bill, we help a lot of working families. No tax on tips, no tax on overtime, no tax on car loans, no tax on Social Security for elderly folks.
You've based your public support for things like cuts to the Agency for International Development, scientific research, and ag research on the idea the budget deficit is unsustainable. Yet the big bill, by all accounts, makes the budget deficit trillions of dollars more. Given your concerns about the deficit, why vote for it?
The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office that scores this bill, they predict there'll be 1.8% growth over the next 10 years. I don't buy into that figure. We've never had that low of growth. We've always had, you know, somewhere between 2 and 3% growth. So we predicate our bill on what we passed on 2.6% growth. We anticipate that will happen. If that happens, none of the numbers that you mentioned will add up on that. Again, go back to the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. CBO also in that, in their analysis of that, said we'd have record low growth. We didn't. We had record growth. So it is predicated on having strong growth, which I think this will do.
That still doesn't get you back to even, though.
Well, I would disagree with that. If you look at our 10-year cuts, we cut $1.5 trillion over 10 years in our budget that we passed last week. That's a record amount of cuts. Now, do I think we could have went further on that? Of course. But this, in the end, was a compromise.
Our listeners have been asking us why you've stated on the record that you're against cuts to Medicaid, but voted for the bill that cuts Medicaid.
I think there's a distinction that needs to be made here. Are we cutting Medicaid? We are. So 1.5 million illegal immigrants that currently get Medicaid are going to be kicked off Medicaid. So that's a cut, right? We're cutting people off of Medicaid.
That's not a federal cut, though. That's because of the Medicaid penalty to states. Their states are going to be forced to drop coverage for children who are on Medicaid, who are undocumented immigrants. That's no federal savings at all.
Well, it is savings in the sense that that's 1.5 million people that are no longer on Medicaid. Secondly, there's
But it's no benefit to the federal budget.
Well, it cuts back on Medicaid. My point is, I'm admitting that we are cutting Medicaid, but for people that are not citizens of the United States. The other point that I will make is, for Medicaid, if you are a young mother on Medicaid with dependents, your coverage is not going to be affected. If you have a child with developmentally disabilities, an adult or a young child, you're going to keep your Medicaid. If you're a senior citizen on a fixed income, you keep your Medicaid. Now, what is going to change, and whether you call this a cut or not, I think is debatable. But if you're an able-bodied adult, you're in your 20s, 30s, and 40s, you don't have dependents, we're going to transition you into work requirements or getting a job. Today, Charlie, we have 7 million unfilled jobs in the country. And so we're transitioning people that are able-bodied adults off Medicaid into a job. Now, that is a cut. We're cutting back on Medicaid, and that affects 4.8 million able-bodied adults.
The claim from objectors to the cuts, though, is that the adverse impact to people who are eligible will be greater than any savings from reducing fraud mistakes in the system. How do you frame that balancing act?
Well, I wasn't what I referred to on 4.8 million able-bodied adults. That's not waste, fraud, and abuse. That's getting people transitioned into a job. But is there waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicaid? Of course there is. In every federal program, there is.
64% of non-senior, non-disability people on Medicaid, though, already work. And opponents of the cuts are saying the bill will make it too difficult for people to certify eligibility and then recertify when they change jobs, as they do. And that'll prevent people who are eligible from receiving what they need. Please address that argument.
Well, Charlie, what I would say on that, this would be a much different conversation that you and I were having if we were $37 trillion in surplus. We're not. We're $37 trillion in debt. So to think that we're not ever going to touch Medicaid, which has expanded by 50% since COVID, these are taxpayers that are on the hook for Medicaid. We got to figure out how do we reduce our Medicaid population, taking a scalpel approach, not a sledgehammer approach. People, this is a social safety net that the people that need it the most need to have, and that remains intact.
We're talking with Congressman Darren LaHood. Thanks so much for joining us. Health advocates say the cuts to Medicaid will not reduce health costs. They'll shift them to emergency rooms and uncompensated care for hospitals, and that the overall cost of insurance then is going to rise as health providers raise their prices to make up for that uncompensated care. Savings for the federal government, increase in the overall cost of health care. How do you address that?
Well, again, I go back to what I said on Medicaid. If we're eliminating 1.5 million illegal immigrants off of Medicaid because they're non-citizens, so if they show up at the emergency room, of course they're going to get treated because it's an emergency room. But that will fall on Medicaid, the Medicaid rolls for doing that, or it'll fall on the hospitals to do that. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't pursue a cutting back on Medicaid for people that are illegal in this country. Secondarily, if you're an able-bodied adult and you show up at the emergency room, you're still going to get treatment even though you're no longer on Medicaid.
But that's going to increase the overall cost of health care.
Again, I think this is a balance on how we try. But again, we can't keep funding Medicaid at the rates that we're doing now because we're $37 trillion in debt.
Many anti-hunger advocates say if fewer families qualify for SNAP, that'll have ripple effects for kids who previously automatically qualified for free school meals or summer food programs. Since the federal government is reducing its efforts to deal with hunger, who should pick up that slack?
Since COVID, we've expanded SNAP and our nutrition programs by up to 50% of more government spending. Now that the economy is getting back on track and we're out of the COVID window, we were out a couple years ago, we got to put in place provisions that cut back on our spending. And SNAP is one of those. Again, I go back to if you're an able-bodied adult and you don't have dependents, we want to get you into a job with 7 million unfilled jobs in the country. So work requirements, transitioning, our social safety net, it should be a trampoline and not a hammock.
That's Republican Congressman Darren LaHood. He spoke with Charlie Schlinker. LaHood is considering a run for the U.S. Senate seat that will open when Senator Dick Durbin retires. That's all the time we have for Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. Join us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.